these are, you know, these manifolds need not to have the same dimensionality. You know, this can be, dimension of this could be m, dimension of that could be small n, and, you know, you can still do a map. And of course, how you do that is that for each point, you have the corresponding map psi here into the r to the n, r to the m now, and then there is a corresponding map psi prime, which is now r to the n, r to the n. So if they had different dimensionalities, if this m is dimensionality of this one and n is of that one, and of course the map, now I used, you know, this thing simply is a map from r to the m to r to the n, and it's defined by, I have to go from here to there, to there, and to there. So it's psi minus 1 composed with f composed with psi prime. Okay, so this is your map, which takes you just from a normal vector space to a normal vector space as you know it. And, you know, this better be some nice map, which maps one manifold to the other. Okay, so that's how you map one manifold to another. So in general, of course, this map may not be nice. And so, for example, it may not be invertible. So it's possible that I can map only points here to there, but not the other way around. Okay, so now there is very, very special type of map, which is very useful. And that's the one which is invertible and which is infinitely differentiable. Okay, so now there's a special map. So a special map and so what you basically require is that it is, so f is infinitely infinitely differentiable, it is one on one, and it's onto, and its inverse, f minus 1, is also infinitely differentiable. So then if you have such a nice map f, then this has a special name, it's called diffeomorphism. And then you can show that basically M and MN have very similar structure. And you can in fact think about, if you have such a map, you can think about M and N manifolds basically as identical manifolds. So then M, if there is a diffeomorphism between N and N, you can sort of think that M and N manifolds are one manifold. And so you can view this map as simply a mapping some points in manifold M into some other points in manifold M. Okay, so you say that these manifolds are basically the same. They are diffeomorphic. Okay, so that's extremely useful. So in other words, this will only exist if M is actually equal to N. Okay, and so diffeomorphisms are, of course, our coordinate transformations on the manifold, and they will play a crucial role for general relativity. All right, so we have maps between manifolds. So now we also want to put some objects on the stage, right? So at this point, we just have the stage, just the manifold, and we may want to start equipping this manifold with something interesting. So for example, if you have a map, you may want to put a lake on the map, and you may want to put a river on the lake, right? So let's do it. So of course, a river is nothing less than a curve on our manifold, right? So a curve gamma on M is simply a map which maps, well, okay. So you take a region which is a subset of R to the power 1, and you map that onto a manifold such that, you know, this is nice and smooth, such that psi alpha composed with gamma on the parameter t, which lives in this interval I, is, well, this is x1 of t and x2 of t and so on, xn of t. Okay, so you require this, that this is nice and smooth functions, are smooth. Okay, so what, of course, what that means is that this is my manifold, and I want to define a curve there, curve gamma, on that manifold. And the way you do it is that basically you introduce the parameter along this curve, parameter t. And so this parameter just takes values in real numbers, right? It goes from, so it's okay. So I have a real line here to the one. And let's say I have an open interval from A to B. Okay. And that's my interval, I. And then there must be a map which takes you from this interval I to the manifold. So for each point on this line, I get a point on the manifold. Okay. But of course, this is quite abstract. So I use my psi's again. So for each such a point here, there will be a corresponding psi map to R to the n. So now I have R to the n. Okay. And so this will map that through the corresponding mapping psi. So I'll have a curve in R to the n, in the end. And so what I'm really interested in, so I compose the two things. So I compose the map which goes from I to here, and the map which goes from here to there. So then I simply have a map from the interval, or from R to the n. Okay, and then you require, this is a simple map, right? And I require that it's nice and smooth. So that's the meaning of the curve. And of course, example, we already know, example is the trajectory of the particle. Example is the river, or trajectory of the particle. So do you see the necessity of having psi's? It's really, I want to always map from something I know, which is R to 1, to something I know, which is R to n. And I'm just using psi to do that. Yes?
We, on the manifold, we have the curve gamma, but then gamma is also one of the maps.
Yeah, so you can think about the curve as a map from the interval to my manifold.
Okay.
Yeah, you can think about it. Both ways, right? So physicists would draw a gamma here, but what that gamma really is like this map from the interval up to here,
okay.
Right? Should be thinking about, yeah, like a map. All right. So similarly, it takes the same amount of work to introduce a lake, right, into your manifold. So similarly, a surface. S is a map from now interval, which is a subset of R to 2 to M, such that when I compose these two things, such that, so I compose again psi alpha with my map S, but now because I have a subset of R to power 2, so I will have two parameters. I will have parameter tau and I will have parameter sigma. Okay, and that gives me an embedding into the R to the n. So I'll have x1 as a function of tau and sigma, and x2 as a function of tau and sigma, and so on. Xn as a function of tau and sigma. And I again require that these functions here are nice and smooth. And the picture is exactly the same, but now you start with a two-dimensional interval if you want. So now you start with R2, and then you have some region U in that R2. So this is my region U. Okay. And then I have this map S, which maps to the manifold. Now I have my manifold here. And this is my map S. It maps to some region, to some lake, on that manifold. Okay, but again, how I define that is that I have the corresponding map psi. And so I look how this looks like in R to the n. And it will look like this there. And so then I consider the map, which is composed of S composed with psi. And then and this is a map from R2 to R to n. And it better be nice and smooth. So this is how you think about lakes and how you think about rivers. Example is the lake, or it's the word shield of a string. So easy peasy, we put lakes and we put rivers. So the next step is to put tensors on a manifold, right? So we want to describe field equations. We need, and these are described by vectors and tensors and whatever. So now we have to start putting some more objects on the manifold. And you know, these are tensors. Are there any questions to this? Is it nice and clear?
Probably not important to us, but can you have a surface on a one-dimensional manifold?
How would you do that?
Does that work with this thing?
Well, that would have to be a degenerate thing, right? So I'm not sure how we would do that.
You could have a surface on a two-dimensional.
Yeah.
I think that you cannot do it because you're going to have only one parameter in your manifold, one dimensional.
Yeah, it would have to be some kind of degenerate thing, which.
Yeah.
I've never seen that.
Okay, just
wondering. All right, so part B, so we now understand the stage and we can put rivers and lakes. So part B is tensors. And what tensors basically are invariant objects, which you can put on a manifold. In variant objects, on a manifold. And so this is very important that they are invariant objects, meaning that, you know, tensor is an object which does not change under change of coordinates. Okay, so these are independent of coordinates. Now you may be saying, well, wait a minute, I know that vector is something which transforms under coordinate transformation by a given prescription. Okay, but the truth is that what you are not talking about vector, you are talking about the components of the vector. So the components of the vector will change under a coordinate transformation, but the vector itself remains invariant. We shall see that in a minute. All right, so now the simplest tensor, of course, is a scalar. So first, let's talk about a scalar function. So a scalar function. Let's call it f. And let's, for simplicity, this would be just a map, which, you know, maps from a manifold to a real number, R1. Okay. So again, I'll be using my map psi. And so how that works is that I have a manifold. Okay, and I want to take the point P on that manifold. And I want to map that point P by this function f to a real number. Okay, so I want to assign to this point some real number here. And of course, to another point, I will assign another number, and so on. Okay, so you want to define f of p gives you a number. Okay, so now how? Okay, so that's fine. So now we can use, again, the structure of the manifold to see what happens if I change coordinates. Okay, so on one hand, I may have a neighborhood O with the corresponding map psi, which maps R to the N. And I will have a point here, psi of P, and then the corresponding neighborhood U. Okay, so that's one possibility. And so let's say this is my coordinate X here. The same point may depend, you know, may be in a different neighborhood, O prime. And so then I have a map psi prime to R to the N. And then I will have point psi prime of P and the corresponding neighborhood. And then again, what you are really interested in, well, how you define this thing is that you say, well, I want to go from here to there, right? So I'm again using my map psi, and I want to go from here to there. Okay, so you define f of p to be, you know, if you go here, okay, I want to go from here to there. So it will be psi minus 1 composed with f. So it will be like f composed with psi minus 1 evaluated on the psi of p. Okay. Psi of p. But now I understand the point p as a function of my coordinate. So you can equally write, instead of psi of p, you can sort of write x. Okay, so what this really is f of x of p. Okay, so that's through one coordinate system. If I have the other one, I do exactly the same thing. I do now psi prime instead of psi. So I will have a function which goes from here to there. Of course, the function will be different because this psi prime is different from my psi here. Okay, so then I will have a function f prime of psi prime of p, which is my new x prime. Okay, so this is phi prime of x prime of p. Okay, but all I am doing is basically I am mapping this point here up to there. So it doesn't matter if I go through this coordinate system. If I go through that coordinate system, it should be the same. I have to assign the same number. So what you have to require is that this is precisely equal to that, which is nothing else than f of p. Okay, that's what we want to define, right? So we just want to assign to a point p here some number here.
The little f, is that the same as that?
Okay, it's a different f. Because I'm using my psi here, and I'm using psi prime in the other case. But it's obvious, so what is really important is that this thing here can be different from that thing there, right? But they cannot be different because I just want to assign the same number to that point, f of p. And so what it follows from here is, so people don't write the p, and they don't write this thing here. And they just look at the transformation property of the scalar. And so what they conclude is that f prime and x prime, so how the function f looks like in the x prime coordinates, must be the same as f of x. And so this is the transformation property for the scalar. Scalar transformation. Which is probably familiar to you, okay? But you know, all that is that I can use various psi's here, but what I really want to define is I want to assign to a point here some number here, and that of course doesn't matter which way I go, if I go through this coordinate system or if I go through that coordinate system.
Could you just repeat the, so when you labeled your psi of p as x, and then in the second line you wrote x as 2?
Yeah.
Can you explain?
Okay, maybe I screwed it up a little bit. So what I'm saying is that, you know, the point P, if I map it over here,
yeah,
will take some, you know, coordinate value x. It will be x1 equals to 5, x2 equal to something, whatever. So I will assign this. So now I want to basically map this thing here all the way here. So how do I do that? Is that I go psi minus 1, and then I use f, and I assign the point here. And that's a map between r to the n to r. Okay. So what it really is like I'm assigning f p to some number, or I could be understanding this as that, you know, using this psi, I'm assigning f of x to some number here.
Oh, okay.
That's what's going on. Maybe yeah. Maybe not. Okay. Let's forget about this. It's not important. This is important. Okay. Very good. So now we understand scalar. That was easy peasy. So now let's do something more involved, and that is a tangent vector. The next step is a tangent vector. And there is a nice geometrical definition of a tangent vector as a tangent vector to the curve, which is very, you know, geometrically nice and whatever. And you will do it in your tutorial next week. So instead, I'll be just using very abstract definition, which doesn't explain what the tangent vector is. Apart from that, it's something which lives in some vector space. Okay. So what I'll be doing as a definition is that I will say this is a directional derivative. Okay. And so what you basically the argument will be the same as I gave you in the front end course, is that if you take in r to the n, not on a manifold, but you just take a vector in r to the n, you may think about the vector as simply the components v2, vn. Okay, but you can also, so this is in a given basis. Let's say I am using the Cartesian coordinate system, and this is v1 in the direction x1, this is v2 in the direction x2, and so on. So I just understand it as in terms of the components. But of course, if I can also understand it, I can combine these numbers with the corresponding directions, and then it's a differential operator. So this is in one-to-one map to a differential operator to a directional derivative. And so directional derivative simply takes a function and it produces another function. Or if I am at a point, it produces a number. Okay, so this is how you define the corresponding differential operator. I take a function f, I differentiate with respect to the coordinates I have, and I'm going with, you know, these components here, v mu are the components v1, v2, v3, whatever. I just contract these things, and that's my directional derivative of a function in this thing. And if I consider this at a point, so if this is at a point p, then this is just a number. So differentiate your function in this direction, evaluate that at a point p, and it gives you a number. Okay? And the statement is, you know, for every vector, I can always write a differential operator or the other way around. So there's a one-to-one map between differential operators and vectors written in these components. All right. So now we will use precisely this as a definition of a vector. So we will associate vectors with differential operators, something which acts on a function and it gives a real number. But we have to make sure that the differential operator is really a differential operator. So not everything which acts on a function and gives you a number is a derivative. But those things which satisfy Leibniz rule and are linear will be a linear differential operator. So what we require here is linearity, and Leibniz rule. And then we are guaranteed that we have a linear differential operator, which is of this type. Okay, so let's do it. So that's the motivation. And then comes the painful, completely abstract, not telling you anything definition of a vector, which is precisely this. So it will be a map from functions to real numbers, which is linear and obeys the Leibniz rule. Apparently has nothing to do with vectors, right? So let's use this abstract definition. So definition. So let curly F be a collection of scalar functions, be a collection of infinitely differentiable scalar functions. Okay, so we have scalar functions, then a tangent vector, a tangent vector, b at point p on the manifold, so tangent vector, b at point p on the manifold, is a map. A map which maps these scalar functions into real numbers. So it takes V maps the scalar functions into real numbers. And we require it's linear such that it is, first it is linear. So if vector it's a linear combination of two functions. So AF plus BG, okay, where A and B are numbers. Then it just returns A times B of F plus B times B of G. Okay, so if F and G are functions and A and B are real numbers, then this must be true. So these are just the numbers. Okay, so that's what it means that it's linear. And second, so it guarantees that we will have a linear differential operator, which is what we want here. And second is that it obeys the Leibniz rule. Leibniz rule. And so if it acts on a product of two functions, f and g, then I will first differentiate the first function and then differentiate the second function. So this will be given by f. Okay, I'm doing the other way around. So it's v of f, g evaluated at p, plus f at p, v, g. Okay. And surprise, surprise, this is a definition of a vector, which doesn't tell you anything, but it's a nice and perfectly well formulated definition for what you mean by a vector. Okay? So as I said, you will see much nicer geometrical definition of a tangent vector at a point in your tutorial. But I thought that this is, you know, more abstract, so better if I cover it here, and then in your tutorial you do the more intuitive one. Okay, so now from this definition, however, it takes a couple of pages to show the following statement. Okay, so then we have a theorem, which I will not prove, but can be shown in a couple of pages just starting from this definition. So set of tangent vectors . If you are interested in the details, please see Walt's book. Okay, so it's discussed there. So set of tangent vectors at P forms a tangent vector space, a tangent vector space tangent vector space at that point P. So tangent, that's why T, point P, and of the manifold M. Okay, tangent vector space at point P of the manifold M. Okay, and that thing, well, it better be a vector space. And so vector spaces have some dimensionality. So the statement is that the dimensionality of this vector space is precisely the dimensionality of the manifold. Okay, so dimensionality of TPM equals to n when the dimensionality of the manifold is n. Okay. And moreover, you can actually write down the basis in this vector space, and you can use it. You can use the coordinate basis. So given the coordinates in the neighborhood of the point P, I can use these coordinates to write down the basis for the vector space here. Okay, and so dimension of TPM is n, and the basis, and then we have a coordinate basis. Basis, and this is d over dx mu, and mu of course runs from 0 to n minus 1. Okay, so this is my basis, and it tells me, you know, I have a vector in this direction, I have a vector in that direction, I have a vector in that direction of my coordinate x mu. Okay, so that's the basis. And then any vector, of course, it's just a linear combination of the basis. So then any vector v, is simply a linear combination of this. So write as V is a linear combination of the basis. Okay, so that's the prescription for a vector, which will be an invariant object. These are the components, and this is the basis. Okay, so that's a theorem which can be shown, as I said. You can look the proof in Wald if you are interested from this definition, but it's not really important for us. What is really important is the result, right? And so the result tells you, well, actually, you know, tangent vectors form a tangent vector space. It's a vector space of the same dimensionality as the manifold has. And I can choose a basis in this vector space, and it's precisely given by the directions d over dx mu. Okay? So given a coordinate system, I write one basis d over dx mu. And then this invariant object is simply a linear combination of the basis. And so that tells me, yeah. All right. Okay, so a picture is super simple. So what is certainly true is that this tangent vector space is not part of the manifold. It's an extra space which lives on top of the manifold. So that's why the following picture is quite nice, is that really it corresponds to a tangent plane. So if I have a manifold like this, then this will be my tangent vector space. Of course, it has the same dimensionality as the manifold locally. Okay, so this is what it is. Okay, so let's plot this sphere and display the corresponding tangent vector space. So let's say an example. You have a sphere S2. So this is my manifold, that's S2. Okay. And then you know that you can parameterize your sphere by two coordinates. One of the coordinates is the coordinate phi, and the other one is the coordinate theta. Okay, so let me just, well, this thing here. And so let's consider some point P on that manifold. Okay, and then this will be the direction of phi. So this is my direction, d over d phi. And then I have the other one. Where do I plot it? Maybe like that. Does it look good or does it look bad? Okay, let's do it like this. And so then this thing will be d over d theta. Okay, this is d over d theta. And then the tangent vector space is simply a tangent plane to the sphere, and that's t p of S2. And in the tangent vector space, I have a basis which is d over d theta and d over d phi. And then any vector living in that tangent vector space will be a combination of these two basis vectors. Okay, so that's what's going on here. So now it's obvious that if I have this vector here, which is a linear combination of the two, then really what that vector means, which is basically if you think about it like this arrow in the tangent vector space, it cannot depend on which coordinates I choose. So if I now choose different coordinates, my basis will now change, of course, but the vector remains the same. Okay, so this thing is an invariant object which lives on the manifold. And so now back to what you know is how the components of the vector transform. So under change of coordinates, the vector v remains invariant. So this is invariant. So this guy is invariant. But I write my v as v mu d over dx mu. I write it as v mu in some coordinates x. This will just depend, you know, in the components of the vector may depend on these coordinates. So this is what it is. That's my vector in one coordinate system. And now I do change of coordinates from x to x prime. Okay, so for that, I use the chain rule of the derivative. This is a linear differential operator, hence a derivative. So under change of coordinates from x to x prime, okay, this is just a number that's not changing, where mu, v mu of x. But now for this guy, for the basis, it's a derivative. I use the chain rule. So it's d over x prime nu dx mu d over dx prime nu. All right, so I just use the chain rule here. But now you see that if I call this thing here v prime nu x prime, then this is just v prime nu d over dx nu. So in other words, it takes the same form, but now in the new coordinate system. So this is just v prime nu at x prime d over dx prime nu. And so you see that although the whole vector is an invariant object, I can understand the transformation of coordinates of this, you know, inducing a transformation of my components of the vector. And so my new components are v prime nu at x prime r d x prime nu divided by d x mu v mu of x. So this is how my components of the vector transform. And that's probably the expression which you have seen in the past. Of course, if I go back to special relativity, where I only allow transformations of coordinates Lorentz transformations of coordinates, this will basically be the corresponding matrix lambda. Okay, so this will just be lambda. And then you are back to special relativity. But for more general coordinate transformations, you just have this. Okay, and it all comes from the fact that vector is an invariant object living on the manifold. All right. Everybody happy with this? Everybody super tired?
I'm just wondering, I probably missed you. So when we had v mu of x, why didn't we go from x to x prime instead of v?
You mean here?
Yes.
Well, in principle, you can write x as a function of x prime.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's what you have to do in the end, right? So you know, you have to do two things. One thing is that you have to find this transformation matrix or whatever. You have to do this. And then, of course, then I want to express my new components in the new coordinates, right? So in the end, I have to plug everywhere I see. I have to actually, I see x. I have to plug it x as a function of x prime.
Okay, yeah.
So two things you have to do. Find the transformation matrix and actually change the dependence x as a function of x prime. All right, so that's... a vector. Now, a covector is a similar beast, but it's completely different. So now you will see what really is very much different. So vector is a beast which eats functions and gives you a number. Covector, on the other hand, is a beast which eats vectors and produces a number. So it's a hierarchy, right? You have a big dinosaur eats small dinosaur. Eats a human, right? So now, definition number two. I have to tell you one more thing. So this was all at a point. Yeah, let me just say this. Sorry. So we had a vector at a point, but of course, I can vary the points through the whole manifold, and I can extend the vector to, you know, everywhere on the manifold. If I do that, you don't call it a tangent vector, but you say it's a tangent vector field, okay? Because the field is defined everywhere. So definition here still will be that a tangent vector field, tangent vector field, tangent vector field is simply V is defined as basically a set all the vectors. So you take V at P, which is the tangent vector at the point P, and so this belongs to TPM, and then you run over all possible P on the manifold. So for all P on the manifold. And what you require is that these vectors join nicely and smoothly. Okay? So you require that V of F is now smooth. Okay? So that's what a tangent vector field is. So basically, for each point, I just define one vector, and then I go to another point, and I find a dead vector. So if these vectors sort of behave nicely and, you know, they sort of intuitively smoothly go around the whole manifold, then it's called a vector field. And so how you require the smoothness is that, of course, if I have V at P acting on F, I get a number. But now if I vary through all P's, this is a function on the manifold. Okay, and now I know what it means for a function to be smooth on the manifold, because we defined a function before. Okay. Okay, so we have that. And then we have a tangent bundle. Tangent bundle is simply a collection of the TP things. So TM. Now it's a sum over all P's of TPM. that's what a tangent bundle is. So what it means is that if I want to describe a point in the tangent bundle, I not only have to specify, you know, the components of the vector, but I also have to say at which point on the manifold I am. So the local coordinates of this thing here will be the local coordinates in TM will be simply, I have to specify what the value of the point is or the value of the coordinates, but I also have to specify the components of the vector. So now you have information about both. Where on the manifold you are, what is the coordinates of the point P, and then what is the components of the vector. Of course, that should remind you something. That should remind you classical mechanics. Okay, so you know that in the phase space, you need to specify both. You need to specify the positions and the momenta or velocities. Okay, so tangent bundle is precisely what a phase space is for classical mechanics.
No, the cotangent.
Yeah,
the cotangent.
Ah, very good. Thank you so much. You are pushing me to the limits. I can't answer your questions. No, so very good. So you have tangent bundle, and you have cotangent bundle. I'll introduce the cotangent bundle in a minute. Cotangent bundle is basically the same thing. You have to specify the position, but you also have to specify the momenta, the covector. So this will be the cotangent bundle, P star M. This is the tangent bundle, TM. Okay? So now, obviously, I have momenta in the Hamiltonian mechanics. Okay, so this description on the cotangent bundle is precisely what the Hamiltonian mechanics is about. So it's the phase space in Hamiltonian mechanics. However, I can do this in Lagrangian mechanics as well. There, I will not have momenta, but I will have velocities. So you will have velocity vector space, velocity phase space in the Lagrangian mechanics. So this will be the Lagrangian description. Okay? Thank you. Very good. So now, what is this covector? What is this p mu here? So it's precisely these other beasts, even bigger beasts than vectors, which actually eat vectors. Okay, so we have a definition. Ah, too high. We have a definition. And it's a cotangent vector, a cotangent vector, or sometimes people say a one-form cotangent vector or a one-form. Let's give it a different name than V. Let's call it omega. At a point P, at P, which belongs to M, is a map. So omega eats a vector which lives in the tangent bundle at that point P in a tangent space and gives a number. Okay, so it, whenever it sees a vector, it just eats it and spits a number. And that's what a cotangent vector is. So now that's a definition. And again, you can have a theorem. Which is now easy to prove, once you have proved that theorem, is that the one-forms form a vector space, which is called a cotangent vector space, form a cotangent vector space. A cotangent vector space, and this is called T star P of M at the point M at the point P. And then you can, so again, this has the same dimensionality as TPM as the dimensionality of the manifold, and this has a basis, so with coordinate basis And the coordinate basis is now dx mu. So now it's the differential. Instead of a partial derivative, it's a differential. And this basis, if you want, is defined by a dualist relation between the basis in one thing, in the tangent space, and the basis here. So what you require, so this is defined by the following relation. So dx mu is a basis of my cotangent vectors. That means it likes to eat vectors. In particular, it likes to eat the basis vectors. Okay. So if I eat a basis vector, d over dx nu, that's my basis of the tangent space. This is my basis of the cotangent space. I define this to be delta mu nu. So it's either 1 or 0, depending on whether the coordinate is the same. So this is the definition of the dual basis dx mu. So you see that, you know, given coordinates, so I choose a point P, and then I define some local coordinates x around that. So then I have coordinates on my manifold. But given that, I can also define the basis of my tangent vector space, which will be a derivative along that coordinate, so d over dx mu. But given that basis, I can also find the basis of the cotangent vector space by this relation here. Okay, so basically you can find everything from there. Okay, and so what you can write is that any one form omega then writes as a linear combination of the bases. So these are the components, and this is the basis. Who has not seen this? Okay, so it's good. That's good. That's new for some people. Perfect. Yes?
How do you have something that eats the tangent vector but is the same dimensionality as it?
It does. it does. So it's, you know, you can see it from here, right? So I'm just, you know, introducing the basis of this thing here, and it's obvious that if this nu runs from 0 to n minus 1, this runs from 0 to n minus 1. So
it's what happens in quantum mechanics, right? Yeah, like the brass.
Oh, very good.
Cats.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Oh, very good. Thank you so much. So this is nothing else than brass and cats.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
We joined the discussion.
But you see that the objects are very, very different, right? One object eats functions, the other object eats vectors. So very, very different, very, very different objects. And they will be different until we introduce a metric. Once we introduce a metric, then it doesn't, that we don't have to care. But before we introduce a metric, then these are very, very different objects which have nothing to do with each other. Okay? So let me again look at how the coordinates transform. And so again, omega, so under change of coordinates. No. Under the change of coordinates, omega is an invariant object, so it doesn't change. So omega is invariant. But I can write it as omega mu at x dx mu in one coordinate frame. And then I can change the coordinates. And of course, this is just a number. It's not changing. So this thing. And I will apply again how the differential transforms. And so this will be omega mu at x dx mu dx prime nu dx prime nu. And so if I define this to be my new omega prime new x prime, then this is how the components of the of the one form changes. And you see that it's the inverse matrix to what we had there. Okay, so we have that omega mu prime x prime is dx mu over dx prime nu omega mu of x. So this is how the components of a one form transform. And you see that this matrix here is an inverse to that matrix there. Okay, so now this was at a point, and we can play the same game as with the vectors. So now we can introduce, you know, we can extend the definition of a one form from a point to overall the manifold. So I'm just running through all the points P again on the manifold, and then I will call this to be a one form field. Okay? And the corresponding space now will be the cotangent vector space. So did I call this? I say, yeah. So this lives in a cotangent vector space at a point P. And if I take a sum over all P's, I will have, so now you define P star of M to be a union over P, P star PM. And that's called a cotangent bundle. And you see that the local coordinates on this cotangent bundle will be where I am, where is my point P, and what my coordinates of my one form look like, omega mu. And so now you see that this is precisely what we need really for the Hamiltonian mechanics. Okay. This is what we need for a phase space. So cotangent bundle and tangent bundle are special examples of so-called fiber bundles. So basically what fiber bundles, well, you know what a fiber is. It just goes from somewhere to somewhere. So basically what you should be thinking about is like I have a manifold which has some structure, but for each point on that manifold, I can have an extra dimensions, extra directions where something can happen. Okay, so for example, in the case of the tangent vector space, I have a manifold, but at each point P, I have an extra space for that point P, which is my tangent space. Okay, so there is an extra structure built on that point P. And so these extra structures built on, you know, above the point P are called fiber bundles. So this is a special example. Special example. So T star of M and T of M are special examples of fiber bundles. Okay. So in other words, you know, if you want to build vectors and one forms above the manifold, if you want to define vectors and forms on the manifold, then we need to talk about these special spaces, which are special examples of fiber bundles. Now, another structure which you may want to put on a manifold is a spinner. So if you want to include, you know, spin 1/2 particles, they are described by spinners, as you will learn in quantum field theory soon. And then there will be a corresponding spinner bundle, which you build above the manifold. And the spinners live there. And again, you know, there are extra structure to the manifold. The example of a fiber bundle. Questions? Lots of strange words, right? Lots of strange things. But what you should carry out of the here is that, you know, you have different objects, you have forms, and you have vectors, and they live in different spaces.
What do you mean by special?
They are examples. Thank you. Let's be. They are. What I mean is like that. Yeah, okay, they are examples. Thank you. They are particular examples. Very good. All right. So once we have vectors and forms, we can introduce arbitrary tensors. And they simply behave as an object which eats vectors and eats forms. Okay, so let's say even bigger beast. So tensor on one hand, you know, you can look at a tensor as a product of vectors and forms, but what it really does is that it eats these vectors and forms to produce a real number. Okay, so tensors, let's put a vague thing. So tensors, they behave like a product of vectors and forms. So that's a vague thing, which is almost true. But now a definition. So definition, a tensor of type K and L. So we have tensors are always described by two numbers, K and L, of rank K plus L. So once I specify what K and L numbers are, then I know that rank is K plus L, is a multilinear map. Such that, so tensor T, and so it likes to eat that many vectors and that many covectors, and it produces a number. So it's a map from TP star times TP star of M, and so on, times T star of P, and let's say there is this. This is precisely how many of these objects it likes to eat, and times TP times TP, that's the other number, there is L objects, so there is L vectors here, and there is K covectors, so it eats them at a point and produces a number. Okay. Well, that's even bigger eliminator, right? So just, it likes to eat many covectors and many vectors, and it gives a number. And so that would be a tensor at a point. And then you have tensor vector field, tensor field, sorry, which would be extended throughout the manifold.
Is M just understood here?
Was he? No. Sorry. What I mean, M is everywhere. There's an M here. Yeah, of course. So I need to correct that. Very good. So an example. So consider a tensor of type 2-1. So let T be a 2-1 tensor. What is the rank of this tensor? 3. Perfect. So it has a rank 3. People paying still attention, although it's almost very late. Okay, so it's perfect. So we have a rank 3 tensor. So the statement is that this object can again be written as a basis. So this is an invariant object, which doesn't matter, which doesn't depend on any choice of coordinates. And it will behave as an object which has two vector indices and one covector index. So it's T, alpha, beta, and there will be an index gamma. And the corresponding basis is D over dx alpha tensor product, D over dx beta tensor product, dx gamma. Okay.
So in the definition, there is in the other direction, right?
What do you mean?
Yes, because in this definition you will address the long form is the natural.
So I like to let's see. Okay, let's see. So the statement is, this is a, maybe I'm wrong, but let's just do it. So this is a 2-1 tensor. So it better like to eat 2 covectors and 1 vector to produce a number. Okay, so what you want to do is that you want to feed T with two covectors, let's say omega and mu, and then 1 vector, v, and this better gives you a number.
Yeah, but you have to do the vectors there, because the basis for the vectors are partial derivatives.
But
yeah.
Exactly. So the thing is that
precisely
vectors eat covectors, just like covectors eat vectors, vectors eat covectors. So if you want to have a function that eats 2 covectors, and has to have 2 vectors in it.
All right. So now, what the components really are is that tensor evaluated on the basis. Okay. So maybe a few hasty. So what these components are? The components. So components. Actually, what they are is how you evaluate this tensor on the corresponding basis. So for example, this thing here will be, I evaluate on the covector dx alpha, dx beta, and on a vector d over dx gamma. And this is what you call a component t alpha beta gamma. Okay, so this, so tensor eats these basis vectors, the basis forms, and a vector, and it spits a number, and the number is precisely the component number. So now it's obvious that if I just plug here what these forms are, it will give me a number. So let's do it. So how this calculation works is quite fun. Okay, so we want to add t on omega, nu, and v. Okay, this better be a number. Okay, so let's write what omega is. So this is t. Now I write omega in my basis. It's omega nu dx nu. Omega mu dx mu. Then I write nu in my basis. So nu alpha dx alpha. Then I write vector in my basis. V beta d over dx beta. Okay. So now tensor is a multilinear map. What it means, and these are just numbers. Omega mu is a number, nu alpha is a number, v beta is a number. I can take it out. Because it's a multilinear map. And these are just numbers, I can take them out. So this is equal to omega mu, nu alpha, and then v beta evaluated on t dx mu, dx alpha, and then d over dx beta. All right, but these are just the components of the tensor. Are t mu alpha beta. So you see that you have an object where you have mu index. It's contracted with this index. This index contracted with that index. That index contracted with that index. So it's just a number. Nu, my nu looks like v, sorry for that, t mu alpha beta, which is just a number. So it actually works. So this is what tensors are. Okay. So tensors eat vectors, eat covectors, produce a number, and this is how they do it. They act as multilinear map. Of course, then you can recover your favorite transformation rule under coordinate transformations. So the tensor itself will not change under change of coordinates, but the components will. Okay, so if I have components of the tensor as we have here, P, alpha, beta, gamma, so I see in the component form, I see that the tensor looks like a vector here in this index, a vector here in that index, and covector in that index. So in the end, the components will transform. This component will transform as a vector. This component will transform as a vector. And that component will transform as a covector. So I will have these three. So if I want prime here, I will have d over d, one, d over d, two, d over d. And then I will have t, t, and then some new, so kappa, lambda, delta. And then I better, you know, there'll be x, and there'll be some x's and some x primes. And then I have to contract the indices in such a way that these first two indices transform as a vector, and this one transforms as a covector. Okay. Very good. Okay, so now it's obvious from this definition that actually you can, you know, if you have tensors of the same type, you can add the two tensors. They are linear maps. I can add two linear maps together. If I have two vectors, I can add them together, produce another vector. Okay, so that's one operation which you can do with tensors. Another operation is that out of small tensors, you can construct a bigger one. Okay, so that's called a tensor product between the two tensors. Okay, so if I have a vector, and so in the components, so I will have a vector v alpha, and I will have another tensor, beta gamma. Well, this is some new tensor, m, alpha, beta, gamma. And so what I have done here is a tensor product. So this will be a tensor product. This is much nicer if you do it. So this was in terms of the components, but of course I can do it at the level of the invariant objects. So I can write B tensor product T equals to M. And then all you have to do is that you have to write this tensor product between the basis of this guy and the basis of that guy. And that's it. Okay? So we will do it. We'll do it on Monday. So that's, you know, making bigger tensors out of smaller ones. Finally, you can actually make smaller ones out of bigger ones, provided that you have some indices up and some indices down. So you can do a contraction, provided that you have index up and index down. So if I have a tensor B alpha and I have another tensor B beta gamma, then I can, for example, contract this index with that index. So contraction between these two indices will give me some new tensor M, which has only index beta, and I'm summing over this index, killing one of, you know, this slot and killing that slot. We shall see that, you know, next time how that is done. Similarly, I could contract over these two indices. So if I have, you know, one index up, one index down, I can act, basically you can eat the basis vector by the corresponding dual covector, and then produce a number, and this is how the contraction works.
They're both gamma.
Sorry?
They're both gamma.
This should be alpha, alpha, beta, and beta. All right, so I'll write the cookbook for you next time. And maybe this is a good point to stop. So you have something to think about over the weekend if you haven't seen these things. So please do the notes until the correction. But I'll return, you know, to these points on Monday as well. So have a nice weekend. And sorry for
lecturing that long.